Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. And we were just talking about some of our shared experiences in telling the management and leadership of many organizations what the mean time between failure actually means.
Well, that's easy. It doesn't mean anything, Chris. But they don't want to hear that. That's the challenge.
Well, unfortunately, it's sort of, in a way, it does mean something, particularly when the customer is asking for it or the regulatory body is asking for it. Or if you've got nothing else, if you've got no other metric in your vocabulary, then that's the only thing you know. So it's the only thing you ask for.
Yeah. See, my first response is to cringe and throw stuff at them. And, I found that doesn't tend to work very well.
No.
But I'm sure our listeners, the folks listening to the podcast, are probably nodding their heads going, yeah, I know exactly the person. And they just insist that MTBF is reliability. And that's the only thing we need to know. And not to defend the use of it, but it's a single number. The marketing guys that created it, I'm sure they were marketing guys, is that when a product gets better nominally, the MTBF number gets bigger quickly. Mm-hmm. So you get these huge numbers and so it goes up and to the right. Maybe it was a finance guy that did that. They like up and to the right for some reason. The problem is that I have a whole website on why it's a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I think you can actually see it rooted in history a bit more. I mean, everyone in the reliability industry knows about mill handbooks and mill standards. Mm-hmm. And these were written in the 70s and 80s, deliberately simplifying the statistics so that people could solve these reliability problems when they didn't have Excel spreadsheets or laptops or even calculators in many cases.
That's right. We had mechanical adders then electrical calculators.
Absolutely. And you've got mill handbooks which outline reliability demonstration test regimes, and it's all based on a mean time between failure, because when these were written in the 1970s and 80s, you just couldn't calculate anything about the hazard rate. It just had to be an MTBF, and that was okay then.
Well, it wasn't even okay then. They had so much room to make improvements that they did anything and made it look better or made it perform better. Products did better. But I mean, I'd learned how to do Weibull plots manually on paper. We had Weibull plotting paper and normal plotting paper and so on. So we could do it. It just was more expensive than doing an MTBF.
Oh, and when I say okay then, what I meant by that is when you're talking about acceptance testing for a big governmental contract, you need to have confidence intervals and stuff like that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I could see how the case could be made that we all know how to do Weibull plotting, but even back then, just having a confidence bound on the MTBF, it could be computationally challenging.
Yes,
and that's the only reason it would be okay, in my opinion, but it's certainly not anymore.
Yeah. Now, we've got more calculating power in our watches than we had available in the 70s. So,
absolutely.
Now, yeah. But that the legacy part, though, of the – it's often one of the things I do, Chris, when I get a hold of a new textbook or a new book about reliability engineering, the first thing I check is how do they define reliability? And usually, like the Pat O'Connor's book, on page one, I think it's in the first or second paragraph, it says reliability is, and it's the four elements that you've heard mm-hmm. me talk about many times. And it's a pretty standard definition. If the book starts with, and I've run into a few of them, even recently published, that start with reliability is MTBF. And I'm like, okay, it's really not worth reading this book.
Yeah.
But it's prevalent everywhere. And I asked a professor one time why he taught reliability using the exponential distribution and using MTBF as the parameter. And he said, it's a gateway drug. He says it gets you started with the I'm not teaching a statistics class, but I want to teach some of these concepts. And And I said, and we had the argument then over a beer, luckily. So it was cordial.
Yep.
But the assumptions, the simplifying assumptions you're using in teaching these concepts don't really help anybody. They don't exist. Right. And so you're embedding an easy method, which then is a surrogate to actually doing, or not even a surrogate, it's a placebo that you think you're doing reliability work in helping people understand concepts, and you're not. So that's where I get into this conundrum, is that it's taught university level. It's in a lot of textbooks. I had the argument with ASQ that you need to get rid of MTBF from the body of knowledge. And they said, well, it's everywhere. And I says, that's because you have it in the body of knowledge. So yes, everybody sure. else has to, you know, says, well, it's in the body of knowledge, so we have to use it and teach it and understand it. And I'm like, so come on, stop. So at least there's a number of standards bodies like the IEC, the dependability group, is eradicating MTBF from all of their standards. And it takes time to work through all those things, but there's progress. There is things going on. But it gets us back, though, to that your opening note, is that if you have a manager that is, they're busy, they have lots of things on their plate, a lot of things they got to deal with, and he comes to you and says, our industry uses MTBF, our customer uses MTBF, what's our MTBF? And we're like, but it's, you know, it's a Weibull with a 2.5 beta, and at 4 years we get this probability. You lost them right then and there.
Yep.
So what do you do?
I mean, sometimes pictures help. I mean,
I was going to go with red, you know, red, yellow, green status symbols. But
I mean, I always say that when I talk to management groups, and a lot of the time the management groups think they know about reliability, and most of the time it's probably because of your university friend who sells that gateway drug, and they're hooked on that gateway drug, and it's not.
And why learn anything more? Why learn anything more? I'm good. This is it. It's simple.
And then you got this level of ignorance, which is itself ignorant, because they genuinely think that they know a good deal about reliability because they know how the MTBF works or what it's supposed to do. And it's if you challenge anyone's paradigm where that paradigm's been in play for years, it's always challenging.
Well, yeah, and that, you know, one of the paradigms, you know, somebody that they'll say they know a lot about it, and I've been guilty of this. It's like, oh, MTBF has got this common misperception that it's the mean, it's right in the title, the average, and we often only know about the normal distribution from school and a little bit of statistics some of us have been subjected to. And we think that, well, that's when half of them fail. So that's kind of, they're all going to be good until they get close to about that point in time. And then a little bit before that, half will fail, a little bit after the other half. And I said, not really. If this is the only number you have and you're assuming a constant failure rate, it's the 63rd percentile. And they're like, what? Mm-hmm. You mean two-thirds are going to fail by that point in time? Yeah. And then over time, I've come to understand that depending on the underlying actual time to failure distribution, it could be 50, it could be 63 and a half, it could be pretty much any number on the number line from 1 to 99.
Well, as a rule, it won't be anything less than 50, though.
Really?
Yeah. So I show a video, which is usually quite useful, I find, and it starts off with that bell curve, PDF of the bell curve, and I show on the bell curve the MTBF, and it is right in the middle of a symmetric bell shape, as you know. Anyone who thinks they know the normal distribution or the Gaussian distribution or the bell curve knows what I'm talking about. That is, if you draw a line right down the middle, obviously about 50% of stuff falls on one side, 50% of stuff falls on the other.
Oh, and conveniently perfectly symmetrical too.
Absolutely. And then I show what happens when we change that PDF to one where the random variable values aren't as far away from zero as they were for that original bell curve. Because that bell curve typically is, you know, for example, if it's centered around 10, that's away from zero. And all those numbers, all those random variable values, all those times to failures are not necessarily always 10, but close to 10. They're all centered around 10.
Well, like if you use an average of 10 and a standard deviation of 1, you would expect failures to really start showing up around 6.5, 7, and yep. finish by 16.
Absolutely. They'd
all be plus or minus 3 standard deviation away from the mean. And usually, not always, usually the standard deviation's smaller order of magnitude yes. than the mean. Not always.
That's true. But then I showed him this bell curve, which is, and everyone understands it because the bell curve is almost ubiquitous in our understanding of random stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then as I morph this PDF where the random variables start actually coming closer or moving towards zero.
You're saying moving more towards early life failures or infant mortality right. type failures predominantly.
In the case of failure, if time to failure is a random variable, then absolutely. But I keep the MTBF as the same for each one of these morphed probability distributions. And as the red line starts changing shape and moving closer to zero, I show that actually the percentage of things occurring before the MTBF, which was once 50, starts increasing, and it goes through 63% once you hit a constant hazard rate,
mm-hmm.
and it keeps going up until it approaches 100% for the most extreme case of infant mortality you'll ever see.
Mm-hmm. So they all fail on day one, and maybe one fails later.
And that one that fails later fails so far away from zero that it effectively means that as far as statistically possible, virtually all your failures have occurred before your MTBF.
Yeah. Now, doesn't that work the other way? If I have a perfect wear out, you know, I get one infant mortality in my lot, and then 20 years later, I get all of the rest of them fail.
Well, that's the point. That's that then creates your bell curve. So if you see most of your failures occur 20 years later, then the MTBF is around about 20 years from now. So well, you still what
I'm saying it's the same scenario. They all fail exactly on 20, right?
Yep.
But I have one of them that failed orders of magnitude earlier. The simple regression would show that it would skew that average lower than 20.
Only slightly, though, if you have all your failures occurring in the 20-year mark.
Okay.
So
I'll have to play with that. I'm not believing you here yet. I need to see the pictures.
I've got a video which I can share with you, which shows you the transition from the bell curve, at least, to that infant mortality.
Okay. I'll have to remember to put that in the notes. Maybe a management material. That just struck me. That's kind of scary. I need pictures. But yeah, I think the basic point, though, is that the mean time to between failures, even though it is the mathematically, it's the total time divided by number of failures. It's not always the 63rd percentile or the 50th percentile. It can be and likely is something different. I had a question come in. One of the people listening to the podcast sent us a note saying, you know, what happens, you know, could you do a demonstration? And this video might be an answer to that question. I'll have to track down that question and send it back to him once we get this posted, is showing, you know, if you have a Weibull that has a beta of 2, what kind of decisions could be, how bad can the decision be if you assume that you are using, or you're just using a constant failure rate? And I've quickly done examples like that in different circumstances to show that you either are underestimated or overestimating the risk to failure. Or the mm-hmm. probability of failure, but maybe working out some real numbers on that and saying, you know, if you've got this decision and pick vendor A or B, you would get it wrong this many times. That might be an interesting way to show this thing.
Well, it's not just a you know, statistical question, because I recently talked about small satellites, and small satellites, they exclusively fail due to wear in failure, and that makes sense because they're produced by, you know, not big manufacturing players. The satellites tend to be one-off. So the whole manufacturing defect quality issues make sense. It makes sense. You'd see that in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
But where I'm going with that is we know as reliability engineers, you would expect to see a manufacturing defect, the root cause of most infant mortality, wear and failure mechanisms. And if it's wear out, then it's things like fatigue, creep, dendritic growth, all those sorts of things.
How the stresses add up and alter your product over time, yeah.
Absolutely. So if you, I mean, if it's infant mortality, then the percentage of failures you expect to see by MTBF is much, much worse. Like, you, as we talked about, 63% of your things have failed by the MTBF. It has a constant hazard rate, and it just goes up and up and up, the more prevalent infant mortality is. But that, if you know that, that actually gives you a really useful opportunity to improve your product's reliability. If it's from a vendor, then you can do burn-in testing, and you know that the products at the end of that will have quite, should be fairly reliable. If you own the product, you know to start looking at your manufacturing processes and not, you know, material selection per se, unless it impacts manufacturing.
Right.
So it's not just the fact that you know the number better. It actually means you can improve the product reliability, which is, as I understand, Fred, you're quite big on that sort of thing.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's what we're trying. We're not just trying to create a value to represent reliability for the data sheet. Right. That's not the end game here. It's actually to communicate how the product actually going to perform so customers can make good decisions. And that should affect all of our decisions all the way back through the design process. And you've heard me talk about this before, Chris. If somebody just sets a goal, oh, it's going to be a 50,000 hour MTBF, but you never measure it or never estimate it, big deal. It's fiction. Nobody going to use it for anything, and why bother even writing it down? And vice versa, if you don't have a goal, and whether it's, and I argue that if you have an MTBF goal, that you don't have a goal or a target. But then, if you only measure it, but then you have this endless argument: is it good enough? Should we ship it or not? And those are just pieces of the number of decisions, or just an example of one decision that knowing and talking about reliability in a meaningful way helps the entire organization and ultimately your customers. So back to this manager, have you shown this video to a management team and gotten, you know, kind of the lights go on or at all, or is this a proven technology that we can use?
It tends to work pretty well. Even for engineers, especially engineers who don't deal with statistics and probability a lot, as you know, Fred, if you're not touching reliability every single day, those skills tend to perish.
That's right.
So I found it very useful for people understanding it. The light bulbs clearly go on in most of the people I show this to. Pictures can be very useful.
Yeah. Well, and it's moving pictures too. I think video is the new thing.
It's even better.
Yeah, even better.
That's right, the talkies.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll have to put that in the show notes so you can check it out. And then I know you have a whole course or lesson, I should say, probably. We'll have to figure out what to do with that, see if we can get that up online, help other, maybe a webinar. We have to.
Although
I know that your schedule is just crazy. Yeah, I think you're in the throes of moving and sorting out new positions and all kinds of good stuff. So it's.
That's true.
We'll have to wait until that settles down a bit.
If there's enough interest, though, I'm sure it could make it happen.
Okay. Well, the way to let us know if you're interested and you're listening to this going, I need to see this video, is one is go over to reliability.fm and look for Speaking of Reliability in this particular episode. The other piece is you can go to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And that's a great place for you. And what I could do is add the link to this show once it's there, or even the video clip there, and make it easy to find for a week or so. But mostly that site is to join the conversation, to give us some feedback, to ask a question or any of that kind of stuff. So if you don't find the video right off, let me know, or let us know through that /go/SOR page, and we'll get you the link post haste, if that's even a word. I'm not even sure anymore.
I get what you mean, though.
Okay, so there's a few ideas, thanks, Chris, for putting it together. You showed me just a little piece of it, and it's like I lost count of how many slides you did. It's like the old brute force video thing. It's like flipping the pages on a book to get the animation to work.
Yeah, that's how they make the Simpsons, I think.
Yeah, exactly. The old school drawing cartoon stuff. But it looked like you had some program that created the curves for you. Or did you do those manually, shift those over?
I had a program which created each curve for aesthetically. I like tracing them out to make it look like it's something more than a copy and paste from Excel or.
Okay. Yeah, it looks pretty cool. So you might have a career in cartooning or animation type stuff. You were in LA, weren't you?
That's true. My life is quite comical right now, so maybe there's some poetry in that.
Yeah, it might work. All right. So, well, I'll let you go. I know you got a busy schedule, and for our audience, take a look at the show notes. You'll see that video, and it's over at reliability.fm under the S. Speaking of Reliability series, and we'd love to hear from you. You can go over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And we'd love to hear from you. So with that, Chris, I think we'll wrap it up.
Thanks, Fred. Thanks for taking the time to talk.
All right, no problem. And we'll talk to you soon. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.